This morning I want to read the episode and focus on one issue, which is not just an issue in this episode of the Torah, but is an issue throughout the Torah and, for that matter, throughout life. But let's first read where we are and then talk about the question, one of the questions, one of the important questions that it raises. So Jacob has come to the house of Laban, and he's in love with Rachel and plans to marry her. And, I did want to say there was one. Look at, for 1 second, chapter 29, verse 7. I saw a beautiful interpretation of this, beautiful and painful, so I just wanted to share it since we've already gone past this verse. Chapter 29, verse 7. You with me? It says, "It's still broad daylight, too early to round up the animals. Water the flock and take them to pasture." Now, the animals we're talking about are what?
Sheep.
Who are often compared to sheep in the Torah? Which people in particular? The Israelites. Now reread this verse. What's gathering up the Israelites? Bringing us to where?
Israel.
Ending exile, right? Bringing them to Israel. And so a Hasidic rabbi commenting on this says, what this is teaching us is, even though, God, it may be too soon to round us up to Israel, please make sure that we're provided for, water the flock, and take them to pasture while we're still in the diaspora. Isn't that a beautiful interpretation? Absolutely stunning. I'm not there anymore. I was at chapter 29, verse 7, but now I'm actually moving on. Okay, but that's what that verse referred to, 29, verse 7, and that was a sort of redemptive interpretation. Okay, now we go to chapter 29, verse, let's start with 14. Just to get a running start. And Laban said to him, "You are truly my bone and flesh. You're just like me." Okay, which could mean you're just like me. When he'd stayed with him a month's time, Laban said to Jacob, "Just because you're a kinsman, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now, of course, the interesting part of this is, does that mean that he's already been serving him for nothing? It could well be. That up to now, he's been working for Laban, and he's been working, why do you think?
Because he wants to marry Rachel.
Exactly. So he goes into her father's business. He doesn't really care if he gets paid, because he's assuming he's going to get paid by marrying Rachel, so to speak. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah, and the name of the younger one was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. This is a much discussed question, whether it means weak eyes, or some people translate it as beautiful eyes. Some people say that it refers to the fact that Leah had been weeping. And then there's a whole series of speculations about why Leah was weeping. The Midrash says that the reason Leah was weeping was because she thought she was going to have to marry Esav, because Jacob was the younger and Esav was the older, so she was going to have to marry Esav, and of course that made her cry. But it seems, because of the contrast built into the sentence, it seems that this is an unflattering description of Leah, because it says, "V'Rachel hayta yifat toar." Rachel was shapely and beautiful. It doesn't say but it does say and. So it still could be Leah had nice eyes, but Rachel was shapely and beautiful, or it could be Leah had weak eyes and Rachel was shapely and beautiful. You pays your money and you takes your choice. Jacob loved Rachel. And so he answered, "I'll serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Now notice, Laban doesn't say how long he should serve for. So Jacob brings up 7 years on his own, which could be because he figures he wants to grow up in this house. He has nowhere better to go. It's not like he's going to set up house on his own before he has considerable property. And I assume he thinks over 7 years or it could also be that it's 7 years because actually in California, the maximum personal service contract is 7 years. And I know that from my own contract with the synagogue, you cannot make a contract for more than 7 years, right? Even if you want to, because that's the maximum personal service contract in California, based, no doubt, on the story of Jacob and Rachel.
Well, Jackie Cougar.
What's that? Was that who, really? Because he was a child.
It's called the Coogan Law.
There you go, the Coogan Law. The Jackie, Jacob, it's
right.
More or less.
It came right.
So, there you go. See, you can really learn things in Torah class. Who knew? Jackie Coogan was a child star, for those of you who don't know.
Too young.
Right, exactly. All right, so Lavan said, better I give her to you than that I should give her to an outsider. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her, which is as romantic as the Torah ever gets.
Yeah.
But it is very romantic. I mean, it's a beautiful statement that it seemed like a few days. Then Jacob said to Lavan, give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her. Okay? Now, the... All right, I won't go. I'll go into that maybe next time, but not this time. All right. And Lavan gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her. The second him in the sentence is obviously a different. In other words, Lavan took Leah and brought her to Jacob. Lavan had given his maidservant Zilpah to his daughter Leah as her maid. When the morning came, there was Leah. So he said to Lavan, what's this you've done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me? Lavan said, is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older? Wait until the bridal week of this one is over, and we'll give you that one too, provided you serve me another 7 years. Jacob did so. He waited out the bridal week of the one, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as wife. Lavan had given his manservant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid, and Jacob cohabited with Rachel also. Indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served him another 7 years. Okay. Now, first of all, we've talked before about the deception and how it's possible that he doesn't know that it's Rachel, but I also want to point out the obvious, which is a theme that all the commentators pick up on is that Lavan is doing to Jacob what Jacob did to his father. He's switching siblings on him, which is perhaps why Lavan says, in our place, right? Why doesn't he just say it's not the practice to marry off the younger before the older? He says, in our place, the rabbis assume, because he's saying, maybe in your place you do such things, but in our place we don't. So you may have substituted for your older brother, but I can't substitute Leah, which, if understood, also explains why Jacob doesn't protest. Because why doesn't he say, well, first of all, it's already a fait accompli. Presumably, if he had sex with Leah, he has no choice. He's got to marry her. But also, he doesn't say anything about how shabbily Lavan treated him, which could, by the way, even though this isn't the subject that I really want to talk about, but it could lead you to believe that maybe Jacob knew. I mean, possibly, although the whole story turns on his not knowing, but still, it's just so improbable that he couldn't tell the difference between when, by the way, their physical differences have already been emphasized, right? It already says, it doesn't say they looked alike. It says Leah looked like this, whatever Einayim Rakot are, but Rachel was shapely and beautiful, which suggests that Leah wasn't. Anyway, whatever the meaning of that is, I actually want to go back and talk about a sort of deeper theme which runs through the Torah in general. And that is the theme of loving one or favoring one over the other. This starts early on, right? The first example we have of this is God favoring Abel over Cain. Now, there may have been a reason for it. Maybe Abel brought a better offering. That's what it seems like. But still, God favors Abel over Cain, and it has tragic consequences, right? Cain ends up killing Abel. Then there are all the brother stories, right? There's Isaac and Yishmael. Remember where Yishmael ends up being the favorite because he's Sarah's child. Then there's Jacob and Esau. Then there's Joseph and his brothers. There's even the story of Moses and his siblings, because remember, Aaron and Miriam gossip about Moses. And why do they gossip about Moses? Because God prefers Moses. I mean, that bottom line, that's why Moses is the leader, because God makes him the leader. And this is the leap, this is the most problematic leap. We see, let me start with this though, we see how every single time one child is favored over another, it causes problems. Every time, right? With the single exception of the end of Genesis, where Ephraim and Manasseh, Jacob blesses Ephraim before Manasseh, even though Manasseh is older, and it seems to not cause any problems. Manasseh doesn't protest, and everything seems fine. And you could read that as, well, they finally reconciled themselves to it, were it not for the fact that even later on, it causes problems with Miriam and Aaron and Moses, and in fact causes problems, for that matter, with David and his sons, who want to succeed him, right? So it's an endless problem. What makes this so interesting is that God does the same thing. God chooses Israel. And after all, even if you don't like the idea of chosenness today, God clearly chooses Israel over the other Canaanite tribes and says, you should take over the land, which leads to war. So it's not only a human problem, it's a sort of eternal theological problem, and it also is constant in the world today. I mean, those of you who remember talking about old acts, if you remember the Smothers Brothers, yeah, used to have that act, mother always liked you best, right? That was a standard part of their act, mother always liked you best. But that same story gets played out all the time in every family, and the remarkable part of it is that God is implicated in this, right? Because God does the same thing. And not only does God choose Israel and favor Israel, but the concept of zechut avot, the merit of your ancestors, is very powerful in the Jewish tradition. And we invoke it all the time. Why in the Amidah do we say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? We say that because we want God to favor us, not because we're so great, but because God loved Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Here, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 7. You don't have to turn to it if you don't want to, but you can if you want. Okay? This is what God says. It's not because you're the most numerous of peoples that the Lord set his heart on you and chose you. Chashak Adonai Cheshek means desire, right? That God desires you and chose you. Ki atem hama'at mikol ha'amim, because you're the least of peoples. There's just a couple of you, right? It's not because you're such a great people. Ki me'ahavat Adonai etchem, because God loves you. That's why I chose you, right? And God's honoring the oath that God made to your ancestors. So that's exactly the kind of statement that got all these parents in trouble, which is a remarkable thing if you think about it. And it's not only the favoritism. There's this, I brought this wonderful quote from Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939. For the error bred in the bone, in other words, the problem that all human beings have that's native to them, that they can't avoid, of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have. All of us want what we can't have. And you know what that is? Not universal love, but to be loved alone. That's what we want. We don't want everybody to love us. We want the people we want to love us to love only us and not others. And that sort of inbuilt problem is part of what's going on here. And what's different with Leah and Rachel, there's a difference between Leah and Rachel and all the other, between the Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob and Esau, which is Leah and Rachel have to continue to coexist with each other. Jacob gets to run away. Leah has to live day after day, night after night, knowing she's not the loved one. Right? And so it reinforces really the primary argument, I think, apart from social stability, I mean, social stability is good, but the primary argument for monogamy is that every human being has a powerful desire to be the special one. And since you can't be the special one for everyone, society arranges it so you get to be the special one, the designated one for one person. With all the problems that that brings, it still satisfies this fundamental human need of being the one, right? Which is why societies traditionally, I mean, over time has outlawed polygamy, except on like Showtime, right? But apart from that, I haven't seen that show, but I know there's a show, right? There's some polygamous show. But that's what people want. People want to have a unique relationship, and that's what makes it so hard for all of these relationships that aren't unique in the Torah. And the counterbalance for this that we'll read about when we come to it, the counterbalance for this is that for a little while, Leah is the only one who gets to fulfill the unique function of being a wife, which is she has children, right? And when Rachel has children, then Leah needs to have more children, because at least she can be the preeminent, right, producer of children for Jacob. But the fact, it's a strange thing that as you go on, the only characters that we find who have multiple wives are kings. And again, it always poses problems, right? For David, it posed terrible problems. But that's because there is this depiction early on of the problems that are posed by having more than one person that you are supposed to love. The other side of this is Rachel's side. And what we don't know is whether Rachel had any kind of active role in this, or was it purely passive? again, you don't have to assume. I mean, it could be that Rachel is an object of desire as opposed to someone who is an active participant in a relationship. But given that she's the one who first meets Jacob and the flocks are watered and she runs home and tells Laban about it, I don't know. However, whatever the story is, the outcome is the same, which is that in the end, it's God who sees that Leah is unloved and opens her womb. So God provides as much of a remedy as God can provide, but what God doesn't do is make Leah loved, because the inequality of love is built into the fabric of the world. Yes, unloved people can still have children, but they can't be made loved, right? And if you think about this, this goes back to, for most people, think about high school. Think about the people who liked you whom you didn't like. And there was nothing they could do, and in fact, their efforts became annoying rather than endearing, right? And then on the other side of that was people whom you liked who didn't like you. And you couldn't figure out what you were supposed to do to make them like you, because such things rarely work. Sometimes, but rarely. Because that inequality is built into the structure of human relationships. There are just going to be people that you like more and people that you like less, and that will always, always be painful. It'll always be painful, right? And that there's no way around that, and there's no way to figure out how to do it. When I read Auden's lines, you know what I think of? I think of the doctor's office. You want your doctor to like you best. You don't even like the idea that your doctor has other patients. Who are these other people waiting in my doctor's office, right? The doctor's there for me. And the better you know your doctor, the more you feel that. You don't feel it the first time you walk into their office. But if you develop a relationship with your doctor, you know, you don't want them to be with other patients. You want them to be with you. And if you know, and if you discover that they have an intimate relationship with another patient in a way that you don't, like, oh, you have his cell number, right? You feel bad about that. You really, I mean, is it not the case? Of course you do.
Is it not the case with the rabbi, too?
It is the case with the rabbi. It's absolutely the case with a rabbi, which is one of the things that makes it tricky. It's very, I mean, every rabbi will tell you that one standard piece of rabbinic wisdom is a rabbi can't have friends in a congregation. Because cannot. You can have people you're close to, but they're not friends. Because friends are people before whom you don't ever have to think about the fact that you're a rabbi. But that can't exist in a congregation, and sooner or later you will discover that the person that you thought was a friend actually still somewhere inside of them thinks of you as a rabbi, and your friendship with them confers a certain rabbi status that other people don't have, which means that they're not friends, right? So that's true for any, but it's true, I mean, it's true for a rabbi in certain ways, but it's true for any professional relationship, right? A psychiatrist can't be friends with his or her patients. Doctor is trickier, lawyer is trickier, but there are some professions where that's clearly the case. But what it comes down to, not the professional lay relationship, but the hurt feelings that it arouses, all come down to the same thing, on a different scale that Leah and Rachel feel, which is some people will prefer some people, and that's just painful, and always will be, and hard to negotiate. And children feel it from parents, and siblings feel it from siblings, and people feel it from each other. So that seems to me to be the most powerful question. And by the way, that's certainly a lightning rod of resentment towards Jews. No question about it, right? We say God loves us. Now, the one thing that I will say is so does every other tradition, right? Islam assumes that God loves Muslims best. Christians assume that God loves Christians best. Jews assume that God loves Jews best. But we had the fortune or misfortune in the Western world of saying it first. So that's always a trickier question. And it doesn't matter how much you try to explain it away, it draws the same sort of resentment that is drawn by human beings when they say, you know, I have his cell number, right? There was all these articles, I don't know if you saw them in the newspaper, about who has Obama's cell number, right?
Yes.
Same thing. But it's an expression of favoritism from someone whose favor you want to curry, right? That's what it is. So that's a big thing. It is a big thing. Okay, so let's stop there for a moment and take questions or comments. Yeah.
Looking at this and going back to last week, we talked about there's not too much mention of love in the Torah.
Right.
Maybe we should discount love more or less in general. I mean, love should not. We should not be looking for love all the time. We should look inside. I mean, that's the other kind of thinking that word of the Buddhist thinking that you should look inside. Dwell inside yourself, discover yourself, not to look for other people to reach to you all the time. Be yourself for yourself. I mean, I don't know but the Torah really doesn't give that message, but basically that's the only way to look at it.
Part of the reason that the Torah doesn't is because the Torah is very oriented towards community. It's not an individualistic ethic. It's a communal ethic. And the truth is, you know, in America, and I do this too, but in America in general, as we talked about actually at the Lunch and Learn class too, in America in general, there's this very powerful individualistic ethic, which is much more Protestant than Jewish, but we've taken it over and made it Jewish. But the only way that you can actually have that individualistic ethic is if you are surrounded by a community that provides you with things, right? You can be an individual, but you sit on chairs you didn't make and drive cars you didn't make and eat food you didn't prepare and all of that. So in fact, we're all intertwined in this web or network of other people. The extent to which you rely on your emotional sustenance for other people seems to me to some extent, on, first of all, it's fundamental disposition and its philosophy, but it's also the extent to which you can. That is, what generally, I, it's rare for somebody, especially, don't forget, Jacob's a young man, and Rachel's a young man, and love is different at 17 than 70. So the idea that you shouldn't look to other people for love isn't, I think, what Judaism would teach. Rather, it would reconfigure what you said as your fundamental relationship from which you get your greatest emotional satisfaction ought to be your relationship to God, not your relationship to another person. And that can sustain you even when your relationships with other people fail, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't look to relationships with other people for powerful emotional charge, nourishment, all those things. Even though also, you know, again, one of the reasons that it may be that the Torah doesn't talk about that is we think of love as romantic love, and that's not always the kind of love that the Torah is engaged with. There are lots and lots and lots of different kinds of love, and so it's too bad in a way that that's how the Torah, that that's how, what people assume automatically when you talk about love, because romantic love is not, in fact, even people who write books on marriage talk about companionate marriage as opposed to romantic marriage. There are lots of different kinds of partnerships and love in relationships, in addition to children and friends and so on. Yeah.
I had other questions, but you just jumped on them. The Torah being, as you've just described it, a connection with love, or the lack of love,
yeah.
It seems to me the Song of Songs was put in this in our literature for that exact reason.
That's what I said at the end of last class.
I'm sorry,
yep. Exactly. That's Gershon Cohen's theory, yeah.
Is it possible, it says in 30 that he went into Rachel and he loved Rachel more than Leah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that mean he didn't love Leah at all?
31.
Does it say anywhere that he didn't love Leah at all?
It's yes, 31.
Well, yeah, it says that Leah is snua, which... Now here's, I'll tell you, in verse 31 it says, God saw that Leah was snua, which they put as unloved, but could also mean hated, right? Mm-hmm. However, having said that, at least one interpretation, which is kind of nice, is that Leah, that it's referring to, not to Jacob's feelings about Leah, but Leah's feelings about herself. That she felt herself to be unloved, so God wanted to boost her esteem by giving her a child. But I mean, think of this from Jacob's point of view for a moment. He loves Rachel. There's nothing wrong with loving Rachel. He intends to marry Rachel through subterfuge. It's not just that Leah steals the blessing, right? He wakes up and he's married to her. So what Lavan did could have contributed to Leah's being hated. It wouldn't be a far stretch to assume that Jacob hates Leah, who, after all, had to collude in this subterfuge, right? She had to go into his bed. She knew what she was doing. So there's every reason for him to hate Leah. How could you do this to me, right? I didn't intend to marry you. I intended to marry your sister. Wasn't unusual, no, but presumably you chose the ones that you had. You weren't forced into the relationship, yeah.
If it's true that Torah doesn't think of love as in romantic love, then what...
I didn't say ever. I just said that that's not the predominant mode of love. Yeah, clearly it does here because of what it says about Rachel and Jacob, and it does one or two other times. But...
But the fact that we say she wasn't loved, she surely was loved by her children. I mean, that's when
she didn't have children yet.
Oh, that's after.
Yeah, that's after. So okay. That's the antidote, yeah.
So I'm struck by the fact that there's no mention of Lavan's wife, the mother of and Rachel, in the same way that, and then in the, it's 29:14, and Lavan said to him, "You are truly my bone and flesh."
Right.
So he's really acting the same way that Rebecca did in doing the same thing. And I just was curious, was there any
Not that I know.
Nothing about the mother and the role.
Not that I know of. I've not heard anything about Laban's wife. So his daughters later, but not his wife. I don't know. I don't even think there's any midrash about Laban's wife.
She's absent, and that Isaac was absent in making of the decision of.
Yeah, although Isaac is more of a presence than Laban's wife. I mean, I can look in the woman's commentary, see if they say anything about it, but the absence of her influence is not as striking as the absence of Isaac's, because the absence of women's influence here is sometimes goes without being remarked on. Yeah.
Did Leah have a choice?
I don't know. I don't know if she had a choice. But if she didn't have a choice, which is possible, then what you have is a powerful depiction of how trapped she was in that world, right? And this, this is, I had a conversation just the other day with, yesterday, in fact, with someone who was talking about the fact that they have an ultra-Orthodox sister who is the happiest person that they know. And that all the things that I said about the place of woman's role, she would dispute. And what I would say about that is that I don't know if Leah had a choice. I also don't know if Leah would have lamented not having a choice. We sometimes project our mentality on very different orientations. So if you actually got, 90% of the women in Saudi Arabia in a room and said, okay, you can take off the chador if you want, most of them would say, no, in fact, it's Western women who aren't truly liberated. We are, right? And this, this is what the feminist movement calls an unraised consciousness or a false consciousness. That's Marxist, actually, a false consciousness. But all I can say is that that's what people say about other people with whom they fundamentally disagree. They just haven't realized that we're right yet. But when we look at the Bible, yeah, it is a very different world. But I don't know whether Leah would have been upset about the fact that she did. I mean, maybe she was eager to do this. Of course, I don't know how many other outlets she had to realize herself. Yeah.
2 points. It's very possible that the reason that Jacob hated or was so upset with Leah is the fact that it reminded him
of
what he did,
mm-hmm.
and he's living
very
with
possible.
That guilt
yep.
all the time.
That would make sense. So every time he looks at Leah, he remembers.
Right, and then as far as the deception of Leah being there instead of Rachel, one of the midrash here says that actually Rachel and Jacob had devised a signal, and
right.
and Rachel, because she did not want to shame her
yes.
sister, gave her that signal.
Right.
But
yeah.
it's interesting to see the progression of their relationship and the jealousy that develops because
right.
Leah is fruitful and
Rachel isn't. Well, the signal business is the original midrash of this is that Rachel was hiding under the bed, and every time Jacob would ask a question, Rachel would answer. But the reason you get a midrash like that is because the story is on the face of it incredible. So you have to try to figure out how this could possibly have happened. And as I mentioned before when we talked about it, that the best explanation that I've ever heard is the mystical one. I don't know if it's actually in the Zohar or not. I heard, I think, Avi Weiss quote it, which is that it's about the fact that the person you go to bed with is never the person you wake up with.
Oh.
Which is a very, and it's... I will leave it at that. Yeah, so go ahead. Okay, 1, 2. Go ahead.
What's the reasoning why men
Is Rachel, I can't hear you.
Rachel gets billing over Leah. She's mentioned
because that's the way it was traditionally in the Mishaberach as well. I actually asked Jules Harlow exactly that question.
Yeah.
He said that was the reason, and also she's mentioned first in the Torah. She's mentioned first in the Torah. She's mentioned first in the traditional Mishaberach, so he put her first in the Amidah. That's what he said. So, yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know. We will come to a more specific reading of several of these lines, but presumably that the handmaidens are mentioned as a foreshadowing because he's going to have children with them, right? Jacob is going to have children with the handmaidens, by the way, as well as the wives. So just thought I'd mention that. Yeah. Yes.
Doesn't he see Rachel's first? Rachel's mentioned first.
That's what I said.
You said
that's why Rachel is mentioned first in the prayer, because she's mentioned first in the Torah,
right,
and because she's mentioned in first in the traditional Mishaberach. Yeah.
Other than the mystical interpretation you just shared, are there other significant Kabbalistic or mystical explanations for this duality in this story?
Well, the Zohar, the answer is yes, but in order to do that, the Zohar assigns all of the characters in the Torah, the major characters, different sfirot, different emanations of God, and reads every story as a sort of psychodynamic picture of what's happening inside God. So we'd have to start from the beginning and take everybody's sfira, like Abraham is chesed, for example. But that the Zohar is a sort of wholesale rereading, a mythological rereading of the Torah based on what goes on inside God. And every story has its significance in the Zohar as it does elsewhere. But we have to leave that aside for the moment. Yeah.
Just about how old was Jacob here?
I don't know if the Torah calculates, but he's a young man. I mean, early 20s. Late teens, early 20s, I'm guessing. Probably, not even late teens. I'm guessing
so
Jacob.
He started working for, right.
13, 14, 15. If he got married, he gets married after 7 years, so maybe he's, I mean, if he worked for 7 years and he already got the birthright, so presumably he's in his late teens or early 20s, I'm guessing. Yeah. We were always a small religious minority. The difference.
Or is it keeping us separate from other, making us be more socially interactive with other religions?
No, it's to the extent that we are separate, it's not because we think we're chosen, right? And in fact, a lot of the Jewish tradition is designed to keep you separate. It's supposed to keep you separate. The laws of Kashrut are supposed to keep you separate. The laws of Shabbat are supposed to keep you separate. On the assumption, among many others, that if you're not separate, soon you won't be Jewish, right? There has to be a certain amount of separation. The chosenness idea has both sides to it. That is, if you're throughout most of Jewish history, Jews were a minority. They were periodically persecuted. They were often poor. So what do you have left? What you have left is, God loves me. That's what you have left, right? And so in some ways, it preserved the Jewish people. What kept them separate was that they lived separate kinds of lives from Christians. Does it draw resentment? Yes, it draws a certain amount of resentment. Anybody who feels themselves special, it may help them feel good about themselves, but it will also make other people resent them. However, as I said, every tradition has some manifestation of this. Does it, for example, does it draw resentment towards Christians, classical Christians, that they think that Jesus is the only way to get to heaven? Yes, it does. But it's also part of the defining belief of what makes them confident in their own Christianity. So it's hard to give up one without the other. If, in fact, Judaism is a people like everyone else, then why go through the hardships of being Jewish? So in some way, what I always tell people is that I really do believe that Jews are chosen, but we're not the only ones who are chosen, that other peoples can be chosen too. We're chosen for one sort of mission. Who am I to say, for example, that, I don't know, that Italians aren't chosen, or the Japanese aren't chosen? They may have their own relationship to God and to history that's different from ours, but is chosen in their way. So I don't want to give up the idea of chosenness. I don't want to make it exclusive, as though God only chooses Jews and doesn't, you know, fool around with anyone else. Yeah.
So then would you say that Cain, Ishmael, and Esau were also chosen for different reasons than the other three?
Well, they must have been chosen in some way, because here we are thousands of years later still talking about them. But I would say that that's, don't you feel that way about your children? Right? You may, in fact, have different levels of love for your children, but you feel that they all have some special place in this world and in your world. So I don't think that we have to say God loves only us to say God loves us, right? And yeah.
Other nations also believe that we are the chosen.
Some do. Not very many Hindus think so, right? Only those who come from Judaism, that is, Christians, believe that Jews were chosen, but a big tenet of Christianity is what's called supersessionism. That is, the Jews were chosen, but they gave up their chosenness by rejecting Jesus. So it's tricky. Some Christians believe that Jews have a separate covenant with God and are still chosen. But classically, Christianity believed that God rejected the Jews because we didn't accept Jesus. So it depends who you ask. I mean, I told you I had this wonderful. I've repeated this before, but it was such a joy. I was at an Association of Jewish Studies conference once, and I was in an elevator with a Muslim theologian and David Novak, who is a very eminent Jewish scholar and theologian and rabbi, and. The Muslim theologian said to him, you know, the way we feel about it is that the latest revelation is the one that is the most comprehensive. There was an early revelation, but it's not like God stopped, and then there was another prophet in Christianity, and then there was a final culminating and more comprehensive prophecy in Islam, to which Novak said, if so, you better become a Mormon. Which was a tremendous answer, right? Because there's always somebody who's going to be a later prophecy, or you better be a Scientologist. But the one upsmanship doesn't end just because we think that they, yeah. We, no? Okay. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
This whole idea of chosen is very much what you said before about, we're feeling chosen because we're the most loved. And that everyone wants to be the most loved.
Right.
And so,
right. It's the Auden dilemma.
Uh-huh.
It's the Auden dilemma. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it seems like the chosenness has far-reaching consequences in many areas of life. And I'm wondering if that's really the psychological payoff that we get for doing all the misfold and even taking on more misfold. We get to feel like Orthodox people, we're the real ones who are keeping the covenant, so we're really the ones who are chosen because we're keeping it.
Well, I don't think that actually, I think it works another way. I don't think someone from an Orthodox community would say, we're the ones who are really chosen because we're keeping it. What they would say is that all Jews are chosen and some of them are neglecting their responsibilities as chosen people by not keeping the covenant. In the same way that you would say, not because I'm the only one caring for my sick parents, my siblings aren't siblings, rather they're bad siblings, precisely because they are siblings and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, I'm upset with them. So I've never heard anyone say other Jews aren't chosen, but rather because they are chosen, the fact that they're not Shomrei Mitzvot is a particular disgrace. Yeah, Rabbi.
Right.
Yeah, you should choose someone else for a while. Yeah. Yes. Okay. It depends. Well, Asher Bachar Banu Mikol HaAmim, vahavta otanu, veratzita banu, which means in that case, chosenness is equated with love. Sometimes chosenness is equated with burden, right? Sometimes chosenness means there are special things we have to do. So it depends who you ask. Mordechai Kaplan, who was the founder of the Reconstructionist movement of Judaism, detested the idea of chosenness and removed it from all the Reconstructionist prayers. So in the Aleinu, he took the line about being chosen right out of the Aleinu, and if you go to a Reconstructionist congregation, you won't find it. And his idea was that it breeds resentment and that all human beings have their own folkways. He didn't call them mitzvot, have their own folkways, and Jews have theirs too. But I think that is, my judgment of that is that that's to misread religious history, because some version of chosenness exists in every tradition of which I am aware. And I think in this, Jews have gotten a bum rap, because it would be a legitimate rap if you couldn't convert to Judaism. Then you would say, we think we're better just by virtue of who we were born as, and no one else is as good as us. But the fact that you can convert to Judaism and be chosen suddenly suggests that it's really about a way of life and not about a genetic inheritance alone. What?
No, but
you can do it. It may not be easy, but you can do it. So it's not a genetic inheritance alone. It's like a family. Yeah.
I think that with respect to the chosen one and the Antony, I want to comment on why men and boys in Judaism are treated so differently than girls.
Yeah.
And so many other cultures as well. Still to today, I think it's very much a men's world that we live in. And I resent that. I do.
Well, and in other words, the men are the equivalent of the chosen of the idea. Well, I think that this is a large and complicated topic. What I would say is this, that the, it was so interesting because I just had this conversation. Yeah, go ahead. What's that?
I'm speaking from personal.
Well, I think you're not alone. I'm sure that every woman in this room, and for that matter, in this city or in this country, would have. And the remarkable part of this, which I think is part of human nature, is that people who live in much more repressive societies, infinitely more repressive, wouldn't say that.
Right.
Because they would say, no, we're perfectly happy with that. That what happens is, as somebody's range of freedom improves, they become more upset about the freedoms they don't have. And I would actually draw an analogy. Please don't kill me for this analogy, okay? I know this is a terrible analogy to draw. I'm going to get in trouble, but here's what I would say.
Go for it.
Why are Palestinians so upset about the difference in citizenship rights in Israel between Israelis and Palestinians, whereas other Arabs live in much, much worse conditions in Arab countries and don't protest? And the answer is not just that the regimes are repressive. It's that Palestinians are living next door to Israelis who they may have 80%, but Israelis have 100%. So in societies where women now have, I don't know what percent, you pick the percentage, I'm not going to be that stupid. But seeing that men have still more, it's infuriating. And the only thing that I would say, which is, you know, take it for what it's worth, is that the speed of the social revolution in the position of women in the Western world is mind-boggling if you look at the perspective of history. And if it isn't fast enough, it's still faster than anything anyone could ever have predicted. And my brother, who's a sociologist, told me a long time ago, he said, I don't care what anybody tells you about ideology. He said, one thing created the women's movement. I said, what was that? And he said, the pill. The pill. He said, until there was something like reliable birth control, it was not possible for most women, right, to create their own lives the way they can now. So it's so interesting the way technology, medicine, rights, they all interact. It reminds me of being told, I read somewhere, that the skyscraper didn't create the elevator created the skyscraper.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. When people learn the technology of the elevator, then they could build high buildings. And here, too, that the pill creates the women. Now, obviously, it's much more complicated than that, and I'm sure that there are many, many books written on it. But it's a fascinating thing. And what happens in religion in particular is religion is always a battle between progress and conservatism, between the weight of the past and tradition and so on, and what's new. And that's why for every social change, there's a huge religious battle, whether it's women's rights or the end of slavery, whatever it is, there's going to be a huge social battle because there's always a weight of tradition, especially on those religious systems that are tradition-based, which Judaism is. Okay, on that note, we'll see you next time.